Today on Flashpoints, we spend the full hour with legendary Pentagon whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg talking about the impending U.S. attack on Iraq and its consequences. Also, Ellsberg talks for the first time about his brand new memoir, Secrets, about the story of the release of the Pentagon Papers and their relevance to the administration's drumbeat towards war. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints over Pacifica Radio. Daniel Ellsberg is perhaps one of the most important and most well-known government whistleblowers to come along in the last five decades. Ellsberg began as a Vietnam-era Cold Warrior. He was a U.S. Marine company commander and a Pentagon official working at the highest levels of the U.S. government. But in October of 1969, Ellsberg risked spending the rest of his life in prison by releasing what has come to be known as the Pentagon Papers. These documents, released to Congress and the press, put the lie to U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam. Ellsberg has now come out with a brand new memoir called Secrets that deals with the Vietnam and the Pentagon era work that he was doing and the release of the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg will be speaking on Saturday the 28th to honor Israeli nuclear whistleblower and prisoner of conscience Mordechai Vanunu. More about this later. Dan Ellsberg now joins us in the Flashpoint studios. Dan, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Very good to be here, Dennis.
First of all, before we delve into your compelling new memoir, Secrets, and its incredible relevance to what's going on today, let's begin with a focus on Iraq, the Middle East, and the significant current events of the time. The current Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, is calling for an almost immediate war against Iraq. He doesn't want to wait for the United Nations or weapons inspectors to go back. Rumsfeld wants Congress to decide immediately to support the President of the United States in a war resolution towards Iraq. Rumsfeld says, "The last thing we want is a smoking gun." I'm quoting him. "A gun smokes after it has been fired. The goal must be to stop Saddam Hussein before he fires a weapon." Give us a sense of your response to this policy and the posturing here.
I can't believe that Mr. Rumsfeld or Mr. Cheney or Wolfowitz or Pearl or their other so-called defense intellectuals believe that a weapon in the hands of Saddam Hussein would be a threat to the security of the United States. More than those weapons, the tens of thousands of them that we faced in the hands of Soviet Union, later of China, a smaller number, both in the control at various times of people who were as ruthless, if not more ruthless, than Saddam Hussein, but who were effectively deterred. The arguments that Rumsfeld is giving right now for attacking Iraq could have been, and in fact were, made for preventive war against the Soviet Union and preventive war against China at the time when it was about to test a nuclear weapon. I actually overheard that it's always part of remotely discussions at that time of attacking China at that point to preclude their getting a nuclear weapon. That was 38 years ago. I'm glad that we didn't go to preventive war. I'm more than glad. That's a euphemism. That was a reckless, foolish policy which was fortunately rejected. I don't believe that the arguments for preventive war against Saddam are any greater today in favor of it, and I don't believe at all that that's really the reason behind Rumsfeld. Moreover, the idea that he would give them without having been attacked, which Rumsfeld is proposing to do here, without having been attacked, the idea that Saddam would either throw a weapon at the United States or at Israel or at any of his neighbors or give such a weapon to people beyond his control whose use of that weapon would certainly lead to his being targeted by the United States and others. I don't think there's essentially any danger of that. I don't believe that Rumsfeld or Cheney believe that there is. I believe that they're consciously deceiving the American people as to the nature of their objectives and the concerns that they really have and what our problems really are. If Saddam Hussein wanted to commit suicide, he doesn't need a nuclear weapon for that. He has gas weapons, undoubtedly, and biological warfare weapons, and the ability to throw them at Israel. Any day he wants to commit suicide, he can do that. He hasn't done that. He hasn't shown a suicidal bomber tendency. And I think his ability to be deterred has really been tested almost more than any other leader we can say in the world. What other leader with destructive weapons like gas or biological weapons has been bombed heavily for 6 weeks, as he was in 1991, without using those weapons? He's been tested. His ability to be deterred from using them has been demonstrated, I think, more than any other leader in the world, and I count on him to have that self-discipline, unless he is faced with death himself, directly by invasion of a country and the clear prospect of his being eliminated by the United States. In that case, I would say the danger that he would use the weapons that he does have right now, which probably do not include nuclear weapons, but gas or biological, is very high, close to certainty. That's the way to get him to use those weapons, whatever he has. Our ability to find them and preempt those was tested in 1991. We did not find a single mobile Scud in the course of our bombing. We did not eliminate one. And actually, the Patriot failed to destroy one, despite the misleading accounts that were given at the time. The chance, then, that if we attack him, he will use those weapons against Israel and against our own troops, I would say, is very high, close to certainty. If it doesn't happen, it will be because he's even more altruistic and rational and disciplined.
Or he doesn't have them.
He almost surely has some chemical weapons that he could apply. He had them then, the chances are he probably still does that. Although, as you say, it's possible that they've all degraded and he doesn't have them at all. But the chances are that he will use them, and in that case, I think, Israel and or the United States will respond with nuclear attacks on Iraq. This could be happening. If Saddam hadn't made his surprising offer the other day to comply with the UN resolutions and permit the inspections in, I would have said it was certain, close to certain, that those our attacks would take place before the election, I felt, or somewhat after the election. He has slowed that process up, perhaps, but Bush hasn't given up that prospect, I think. I think there's still a heavy prospect of its going ahead extremely unwisely, illegally, aggressively. And I think that means we will face, the world will see nuclear weapons before this year is out, perhaps. That's an extremely ominous prospect for this species.
The mantra that I find very interesting from the administration is, it's not about weapons inspectors, it's about disarmament. Disarmament more easily follows weapons inspectors being on the ground. We had Scott Ritter many times on these microphones talking about how they were rather thorough on the last round and how they could wipe them out if they were on the ground taking notes, being allowed the kind of access that they did in fact have. What do you make of this kind of rhetoric? It's not about the inspectors. It seems like the U.S. is more angry with Iraq since they've agreed.
There's a mixture of truth and lies in what we've heard from the administration. The truth we've heard from, I think, is the repeated statements by Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush that changing the government of Iraq is, that nothing other than that will be satisfactory to the United States. And what the UN is proposing, or even the more vigorous forms of that, of actually putting in armed inspectors and whatnot and getting, you know, ferocious disarmament, doesn't accomplish that regime change that this administration, I believe, truly does want. But it doesn't want it for reasons of preventing an imminent or short, at all easily foreseeable, threat to the United States from Iraq. That's a lie, I believe. It wants a regime change. As Rumsfeld says, we want to occupy. We will occupy for a prolonged period once we get in there. He said, but don't worry. He said, the United States doesn't covet any lands. Well, that's true up to a point. It's the oil under the land that we covet. And to control that adequately, we don't any longer regard Saddam as an adequate agent for that. And the Saudis aren't looking that good to us either anymore. So regime change of a kind in Iraq seems essential to them. For that, as I say, no amount of inspection could satisfy that. The notion that this is about disarmament, per se, but that we would be content with that, with a Saddam in other words, or a regime that isn't totally controlled by us, sitting over the oil, whatever happened to their weapons of mass destruction, I think, is totally misleading. That's not what this is about.
You alluded to this, but I just want you to get it solidly on the record. You mentioned the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons. Talk more about your most pressing concerns if we do see this kind of all-out war.
There's really a number of things. At the top of that list, and this is prior to any use of nuclear weapons, would be the killing of thousands, probably tens of thousands, of innocent Iraqi civilians, men, women, children, with the kinds of faces that we've been seeing daily in the New York Times and elsewhere, of the kinds of faces that people were killed in the World Trade Center. Those ads, or those news stories, I think, could have brought home to us what it means to what we call collateral damage, and what was collateral damage, let's say, to Timothy McVeigh, or to, for that matter, Osama bin Laden. Each of those people represented a family, you know, there's a hole in the universe. For a number of people, we've been made very humanly aware of that. And it could have caused us, I think, to think about what it means to be causing such damage by bombing and other weapons of mass destruction when we do it. Those dots have not been connected by very many people. I don't see any way of invading and occupying Iraq without fighting in the cities, ultimately, and causing enormous damage. So that's the first thing I would list. I noticed, for instance, in an article by two people from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, they listed in the New York Times the costs to the U.S., and they started with U.S. soldiers dead, which are certainly indeed among those costs, but their list did not include Iraqi civilians. They did mention that in terms of a cost to the world. Well, I say that for American citizens in an aggressive war, not sponsored by the United Nations, to be killing those civilians is murder and terrorism. And that, I would put, is a very, very heavy cost to our moral position, to our status as citizens of this country and of the world. Yes, there will be major cost, the deaths of American soldiers, and as in Vietnam, for a cause no better than they died in Vietnam. The word then was wasted, and these lives will be wasted too, along with the people that we kill. Third, the spectacle of Americans killing Arabs, Muslims, civilians in particular, in large numbers, in TV all over the world, will cause a rage and hatred for this country and for our leaders, for our policies, and really for the people who supported this policy, that I think will be unlike any much that the world has seen before. And it will generate, I think, a generation of terrorists who are willing to give their lives to take some Americans with them. I think, in other words, it will greatly increase the dangers, which are already quite serious, are real and serious dangers to our country, of the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism. Al-Qaeda will, I think, its recruiting will be enormously increased by this, despite the pressures we're putting on them. So this runs totally counter to the war on terrorism or the struggle on terrorism, greatly increase our risks of terrorism in the future. The precedent, finally, of the possible use of nuclear weapons, which would probably follow significant damages in Americans and Israelis of Saddam's use of gas or biological weapons. The nuclear weapons precedent would not immediately lead to the blowing up of the world, as it might have during the Cold War. It'll be a precedent for first use that will be exploited by India and Pakistan against each other, possibly very shortly. It will legitimize, in effect, that use and cause nuclear weapons to be seen as something usable, necessary, legitimate, endorsed by the world's mightiest power, the U.S., and its agent, in this case, Israel. And I think will greatly increase the dangers of survival. So when I talk about a threat to the species earlier, that wasn't rhetorical. I think the first use, that whoever does it, the next first use of nuclear weapons after Nagasaki, actual exploding on people, will markedly increase the short and midterm risks to the species, ultimately. This administration is right on the track of bringing that about.
We're speaking with Daniel Ellsberg, and we're talking about the current situation in terms of the drumbeat towards war. And we're delighted to have him in the studio. He's got a brand new memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. And I am delighted to have you here at this very crucial moment because the material of your life from the Pentagon Papers, your experiences, this book opens up and we're going to talk about it with the Gulf of Tonkin, are so relevant. And I want to begin by saying that I am shocked as a journalist to see other journalists like at National Public Radio becoming stenographers for the Pentagon, for U.S. officials. And this following power without questioning it is sort of the whole evolution of your life into the activist that you became. So let's start a little bit at the beginning. Let's move back a little bit, start at the beginning of the book, and then very quickly get into the relevant lessons that we could learn from Gulf of Tonkin.
I think it should be mentioned, by the way, that this book isn't available till mid-October. It hasn't been published yet. You have a rare pre-publication copy in your hands, and of course, when you invited me here, I'm looking forward to speaking about the current crisis primarily, but there are great parallels.
Dan, talk about how you first came to learn about Vietnam. I think you first visited in 1961.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as a part of the Defense Department Task Force.
And what did you learn in that first visit?
As I said in the book, you don't have to be an ichthyologist to know when a fish stinks. I was no expert on Vietnam, but it was very clear that our policy there was not succeeding and had no prospect of succeeding, ever.
One of the first major encounters that gave you a real sense of the role that you would be playing, which is essentially supporting a huge lie, came about with the Gulf of Tonkin encounter in 1964. Would you remind people what that was and what you learned was going on behind the scenes?
Well, the relevance of that episode is so extreme that I have the feeling that I'm almost reliving that history right at this time. The administration at this moment is in the process of steamrolling the Congress toward a blank check, essentially, a resolution of support for action, violent action, of whatever the president decides is appropriate, a pre-delegated declaration of war, in effect. And here, in this case, where the UN is, quote, seized with the problem, they are debating right now what the appropriate UN action would be, the president wants to preempt. That wasn't happening in 64. It should have been. There should have been UN action to restrain the United States right at that time from aggressive action, but there wasn't. Instead, the Congress in 64 was being lied to about the nature of the evidence in the possession of the administration, lied to about direct threats to American forces, the nature of them, and thought that they were doing nothing but endorsing a president's action to defend U.S. forces. A U.S. destroyer had been attacked on August 2nd in daylight, Sunday afternoon, in the Gulf of Tonkin. The context of that attack was absolutely not told about and lied about. Was lied about to the American public. It was described as being on a routine international patrol in international waters. In fact, it was an intelligence mission, which was acting very provocatively toward the coastal radars to get them to turn on in preparation for an American action, invasion, or attacks on North Vietnam. And it was accompanied by direct attacks that were going on that were then, when word of them finally got out, have always been described to this day, really, by American officials, such as retired Secretary of Defense McNamara, as Vietnamese operations, of which we were aware. PT boats that were firing mortars and rockets and kidnapping people directly on the coast of North Vietnam, direct attacks. They weren't Vietnamese, South Vietnamese operations. They were entirely U.S. operations, using some South Vietnamese personnel and some other CIA, quote, assets from around the world, Taiwan, Thailand, elsewhere, even perhaps some Cubans, definitely some Norwegians. They were American operations, American boats, American training, everything. I was aware of that on my first day in the Pentagon, which happened to be August 4th, 1964, by coincidence, the day of an alleged second attack, which gave him, of course, reason then to call for a resolution of support right away. Here are American destroyers. But an American destroyer was supposedly being attacked again. To that, of course, we had to make a very fast response, and Congress came aboard. Rubber stamp hearings, hardly any challenge except by Senator Morse, who got a leak from someone in the Pentagon that on the Foreign Relations Committee, that he should ask about exactly where those ships were and what they were doing and their intelligence mission and the provocative operations. But McNamara simply lied in his answers to Morse. The hearings were very perfunctory. Morse and Senator Gruening of Alaska were the only two people in all of the Congress, two senators, no representatives, who voted against that.